Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison, and I'll be with you for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so as we talk about recent developments in the public safety workplace. And of course, you've got to start with the impact of COVID-19. It's just about all that is on anybody's mind right now. I do have a few cases I'd like to talk about if I have time. The wheels of justice never seem to stop. But let's start by talking about the workplace issues that have arisen as a result of COVID-19. And first of all, let's talk workers' compensation. We have any number of public safety employees. We don't have an exact count yet, but certainly we're numbering in the hundreds, if not in the thousands at this point, who have come down with COVID-19. We have a number of public safety officers who have died, and the eyes of those employees and their families are turning to whether or not COVID-19 is going to be considered a compensable disease for purposes of workers' compensation laws. So first of all, what's the lay of the land out there generally before the flurry of activity that we've seen in the last few weeks? The lay of the land is that workers' compensation laws vary from state to state. There's no federal workers' compensation law. Well, there is one for federal employees, but there's no federal law that covers state, municipal, and county employees. And the standards for what is a compensable illness or injury under those state workers' compensation laws vary pretty wildly from place to place. Some states you'll find stress claims almost impossible to make. In other states, you will see PTSD lined out as a compensable disease. But one thing that almost all of those state laws have in common is they make it almost impossible to file a claim for a disease. What they do is they impose on the employee a burden of proving that the disease was caused by the job. And that is a burden that has proven almost impossible to overcome. Because, of course, you can get a disease from any of a variety of different sources. Sure, you may have had a needle stick while on the job, while you are, if you're an EMT, transporting somebody who is flailing around, or if you're an officer while arresting someone. But does that mean that your hepatitis came from the needle stick? You don't know. You'd have the burden of proving that in the workers' compensation system. And so the lay of the land coming into COVID-19 was pretty bleak for public safety employees as to whether or not their claims for their COVID-19 would be considered work-related. What has happened, this flurry of activity that I'm talking about, has been that a number of states, in a number of ways, have moved to a system of presumptive causation for COVID-19 claims for not just public safety employees, but all emergency responders and healthcare employees. So what does presumptive causation mean? What it does is it shifts the burden of proof. If the employee comes down with a presumptive causation condition, it becomes the employer's burden of disproving that that condition was caused by the job. It creates a presumption that the job caused the disease. And a variety of states around the country have now moved to COVID-19 presumptions. We have a table that we have prepared of all of those laws. We have published it through our regular emails that we send out. And right now we're standing at about a third of the states have established presumptive causation for COVID-19. Maybe. Why do I say maybe? And the reason is that in a number of these states, by my count, most of those states that have moved to presumptive causation, it hasn't been a result of the legislature. There have only been a few states, a handful, where the state legislatures have actually gotten in and passed presumptive causation laws. Minnesota, for example. In the other states, it has been the governors who have done this by an emergency decree, where they've issued some sort of proclamation. Sometimes they've done it under their own name. Sometimes they've done it through the workers' compensation administrator in the state. But something that they have issued that says, we are going to presume for our workers' compensation systems that COVID-19 is caused by the job. And the reason that I used the word maybe about a minute ago is that there is a question as to whether or not presumptive causation can be done by decree of a governor. Already in one state, Illinois, the governor's decree was challenged by an employer group, or actually several groups of employers. In Illinois, it was the decree actually came out in the form of a rule change for the Workers' Compensation Commission. They challenged it in court in a southern Illinois county, and the court ruled in favor of the employers and struck down the legality of the presumptive causation law. Now, the unions in Illinois are banding together to try to get the legislature to take action. So there is a question for those states where this has come into play by virtue of a governor's edict as to whether or not that is going to hold up. We shall see. I suspect the answer is going to come down to what the state constitutions say in those states about the degree of emergency authority that is given to a governor. By the way, the most recent development, I'm recording this on actually May 6th, the first Thursday in May. A recent development is that just a couple of hours ago, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, announced that he was about to issue a proclamation or an emergency order creating the presumptive causation in California. So stay tuned on that issue. Second issue that has been coming up in the workplace as a result of COVID-19 is hazardous duty pay. This has been one where I've gotten actually a fair amount of phone calls from people saying, should we pursue hazardous duty pay for COVID-19 first responders? And I have found unions to be of a decidedly mixed mind on this question. There are some who are saying, look, shouldn't we get paid extra money if we are being required to expose ourselves and derivatively our families to this condition, to this disease, and it is a disease which can take our lives, shouldn't we be paid more? And then on the other hand, you have unions that say, well, the optics on this are pretty bad. We get paid as public safety employees. We get paid to put our lives on the line. And this isn't substantially different. And we don't want to look greedy or whatever in the minds of the public. Most unions right now that I've seen are falling in the latter camp, and they are not pursuing hazardous duty pay. But that doesn't mean that hazardous duty pay isn't coming into the country, into the public safety workplace, because it is. And it's coming in by employer action rather than the request of the unions. We've seen this in a number of jurisdictions in my neck of the woods, in Washington and in Oregon. We have seen employers actually supporting hazardous duty pay in a variety of state legislatures. We will post a link for you. There is an EMS website that tries to keep a table of the various types of hazardous duty pay that are out there. And we'll put that link on our website so you can see the various examples of it. But we now see hazardous duty pay in dozens and dozens of jurisdictions around the country, and jurisdictions all over the country, East Coast, West Coast. It doesn't seem to be a geographically oriented benefit like sometimes these sorts of things are. Would hazardous duty pay be a negotiable issue? Sure. Could a union demand to bargain midterm in the contract for hazardous duty pay? Probably not. Would the union have the right to bargain over the amount of hazardous duty pay if the employer decides to implement it? Probably. Is any bargaining going on over hazardous duty pay? No, not that I've seen. It's just when the employer takes the unilateral actions, I've seen the unions say, thank you. We appreciate it. We appreciate being recognized. Third issue that's come up is something that involves the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, the FFCRA, very unfortunate acronym, right? This is or was the first bill passed by Congress in response to the pandemic. And in it, Congress created for the first time at the federal level any form of paid leave. And this was a form of special sick leave, 80 hours of special sick leave, not at full pay, but at a partial pay. But still, it was something. It was kind of a foot in the door for employees for getting any form of federally mandated paid leave. However, Congress created an exception. And the exception was for what Congress referred to as emergency responders. And that term wasn't really adequately defined. Subsequently, the Trump administration has issued clarification as to what emergency responder means. And that clarification indicates that it includes police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and corrections officers. They're all thought of as being emergency responders, although you could quibble with that, but nonetheless, that's what the rules are. And what did employers do in response to this? This was an exemption that was a permissive exemption. Employees weren't automatically exempted from the paid leave. Rather, the employer could claim the exemption. And we saw an initial wave around the country of employers claiming that exemption, saying, you know what, police, fire, they have adequate amounts of paid leave in their collective bargaining agreements. They don't need this extra form of paid leave, and we don't need the complications that it brings. And in the last 3 weeks or so, we have totally seen the ground shift on this whole issue. I've seen employer after employer take the position that we are not going to exempt ourselves from paid leave under the FFCRA. Not only that, we're not just going to give our first responders 80 hours of paid leave at the FFCRA reduced rate. We're going to give it to them in full pay, and it is not going to be accompanied by any drawdown in any paid leave account. Just yesterday, the city of Portland, my city, announced that for its police officers. So we're seeing sort of a complete turn of the tide on this notion of a special form of paid leave for employees who are suffering from COVID-19. And most employer policies that we have seen don't even necessarily require that the employee have contracted COVID-19. They actually will allow paid leave to be used for a quarantine period subsequent to exposure to COVID-19. The fourth issue that I want to talk about COVID-19 in the workplace, and I'm going to talk about five all told, by the way. The fourth issue is one that's going to be with us for a long time. COVID-19 has blown a hole in public employer budgets all around the country. There was a news article last week. The headline to the news article was, "From Houston to New York, America's municipal finances are in tatters." And indeed, that's true. The degree of harm that is done to you is going to depend upon the tax structure in your state. But if you were in a state where cities and counties and the state itself rely on either income tax or sales tax, you are looking at employers that are in dire financial straits at this point in time. Those that rely heavily on property taxes, not so bad, although there will be a long-term impact of that. And one of the areas that is the hardest hit are state pension systems, because we have seen, as we all know, we've seen the bottom fall out of the stock market. And that means that the funding ratios in these state pension systems are quite, and they're very much in trouble, and it's going to take probably years for them to recover. So let's talk about both of those issues separately, the general finances and then the pension issue. First of all, as to general finances, how are employers responding? Well, right now, most employers aren't making changes. They're not laying off employees. They're not furloughing employees yet. They are not trying to obtain wage concessions. But you're starting to see the drumbeats on all of those issues. I'm just looking at a few headlines right now. Ohio mayors say they will have to lay off firefighters and police without federal help. Another headline, city budget shortfall means New Mexico firefighters could face furloughs. A big headline that circulated for a couple of days. Hawaii governor wants to slash first responders' pay by 10% to cover the budget gap. 10%, by the way, for first responders. For everybody else, it would have been 20%. We are seeing employers reject tentative agreements that have been negotiated to settle a collective bargaining agreement. So, for example, I'm looking at a New York article right now where what's called a fiscal court looked at a contract that was bargained in good faith before the time of the pandemic, and it was rejected. We are seeing some employers that have been asking public safety unions for pay cuts. Probably the most, I think, notorious in the country of this was the city of Topeka in Kansas, where the police and firefighter unions learned, apparently by reading the newspaper, that the city intended to cut their pay by 3%. The governor of Kansas weighed in and referred to those pay cuts as, in her words, absolutely insane. And eventually, Topeka backed down on the pay cuts. I'm just looking through or leafing through a whole bunch of headlines from news articles around the country, and they use terms like shared sacrifice and a slashing of the budget. In Baltimore, so hard hit by all sorts of problems, financial problems for years now, in the middle of the COVID-19 response, when you have understaffed police and fire departments just overworked responding to the COVID-19 crisis, you have the city announce to the unions that pay cuts now have to be discussed. We are also starting to see layoffs in response to COVID-19. And collective bargaining for those jurisdictions where collective bargaining was in process, that's essentially come to a halt. Every once in a while, I'll see a report of a contract that is extended by a year or two. In one very important example, that of the city of Philadelphia, the city actually extended the contract by a year and gave police officers a 3.5% raise. But by and large, everybody is treading water right now, waiting to see what the future is going to bring. Everybody's just hoping as to whether or not municipal and county and state finances are going to snap back once we get through this, once we recover asset value in the stock market, once people start having incomes again on which they can pay income tax, and once they continue to buy things, which would give us sales tax. So what about those pension issues? Well, we have a lot of underfunded pension systems in the country. Probably the worst case in Illinois, where some of the funding ratios in public pension systems are in the 20% range. Not making that up. That's actually true. And, of course, the asset value in these pension systems has dropped with the fall in the stock market. And these pension systems and the state governments associated with them are looking for federal aid. That has become a political football in Washington, D.C., whether or not federal aid will come to states. Federal aid has come to cities. It has come to counties. But so far, the aid bills that have come out of Congress do not provide any relief for state budgets. And the political football around pensions started with the president of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who announced, I think he announced it on a talk show, he announced that there will be no aid that goes to the states where the states are suffering from pension problems. Instead, what we should do is allow the states to declare bankruptcy. So what's he talking about there? Well, cities can declare bankruptcy under the federal bankruptcy laws. And you saw that with Detroit, for example, and a few other cities that you saw in the wake of the financial crisis and even before. States, however, cannot declare bankruptcy. And what Senator McConnell is talking about is changing the bankruptcy laws to allow them to declare bankruptcy. Why? He's quite open about this. He says your pension benefits are too generous, and you need to cut your pension benefits. So what's the law on this? If an employer, a public employer, can declare bankruptcy, is it allowed to cut the pensions that have been promised existing employees? And is it allowed to even cut the pensions of retirees? And the answer is, or the answers are, yes and yes. We saw that. We saw that, I think, most notoriously with Detroit. When Detroit went into bankruptcy, there was a federal court that ruled that a pension debt, a debt that is owed retirees or active employees, is no different for purposes of bankruptcy than any other debt. And if the employer is bankrupt and can only pay out 50 cents on the dollar for all of its debts, then those pensions are going to be cut 50%. Even for existing retirees. And we've seen that ruling in a variety of other states as well. So when Senator McConnell is talking about no bankruptcy for those states that have pension problems, what he is talking about, and he says this explicitly, I'm not putting words in his mouth here, is we need to cut the public employee pensions in those states. And of course, the states that he's talking about happen to be states that are dominated by one political party. I mean, like, what a shock. But his rules, as he's announced them, would apply to all states. Well, there was a lot of blowback. You probably saw the biggest public blowback from Mario Cuomo, who referred to the idea, and this would be Governor Cuomo's words, as insane. And the reason he would be saying that is, or the reason he said it, the way he articulated it was, look, if we let states get out of their debts, do you know what is going to happen to the public finance markets, the bond markets in the country? You will kick us into a depression if you allow states to declare bankruptcy. And this is not just Governor Cuomo, who's quite outspoken on a lot of issues. This is governors of both political parties who reacted kind of in joint horror at what Senator McConnell was suggesting. Now it appears that Senator McConnell has backed down. This has been in the last few days from his initial position. And what he is suggesting, and it's just a trial balloon, is that there might be some federal aid coming if the states will pass laws that eliminate lawsuits that arise out of the COVID-19 pandemic. He's not talking about what kind of lawsuits yet. We don't really have that detail. But there's the possibility now that we may get some federal aid. All right. That's a slug of economic issues and not a lot of good news. I want to talk for my last COVID-19 discussion. I want to talk about an issue that has come up a variety of times in the last month. I've gotten a lot of emails from different people, and the emails have kind of increased in frequency in the last week or 10 days as we've seen these kind of public protests over the lockdown for COVID-19. Now, let me read you one of the emails. I'm not going to identify who sent it or where they were from, but this is very, very simple email, straightforward email, and it asks the same question that I've been asked a lot of times. Question: during the COVID crisis, our members are being urged to arrest citizens who are not in compliance with our governor's unilateral mandate on social distancing, aggregation of citizens, and failure to wear a mask. These are not laws passed by the legislature. Our members are fearful of false arrest and 1983 actions. Do you have any experience or insight concerning this issue? I actually have a little bit of experience with it, but I've also looked into the issue, done a fair amount of research on it. And here's the advice I would give everybody if you're facing those sorts of questions. Number one, police don't get to decide whether laws are constitutional or not. That is not the job of a police officer. And a police officer acts at her or his risk if they act on the basis that a law, perhaps a law with which they disagree or maybe even agree, is unconstitutional. It's the job of courts to declare laws unconstitutional. And if an employer orders a police officer to enforce a law that has not been declared unconstitutional, and the officer says, no, I'm not going to do it, it's an illegal law, or I disagree with that law, that officer could be disciplined up to and including terminated for insubordination. And there are cases on this, and there are cases that actually go back 20 years. I'll give you a brief description of two of them. One of them involved a Chicago police officer who was assigned to provide security around an abortion clinic where there were some anti-abortion protests that were going on. The officer, who was a Catholic, was opposed to abortion. He refused to serve on the security detail. He was disciplined for insubordination. Result? Discipline upheld. Then there's an Indiana case, and this involved a state trooper who was a fundamentalist Christian, and in his version of religion, I forget the name of the religion, gambling was not allowed. He was assigned to work a security detail at one of those riverboat casinos that are on so many states and the rivers of so many states in the Midwest. He refused. And the employer ordered him again to serve on the security detail. He said, I can't. It breaches the tenets of my religion. He was fired. The result? The court upheld the termination of the trooper. Police don't get to decide what laws they are going to enforce. It's just that simple. And if you have any of your officers or deputies who are thinking that they shouldn't be enforcing these lockdown orders because they believe those lockdown orders are unconstitutional, please intervene. Stop the problem before you get to the level of insubordination. Now, let me go another step. Nobody asked, but I'll try to give my answer at least. Are these lockdown orders constitutional? That's the argument that is being made. That's what some of these signs say when you see the demonstrations. This is trampling on my rights. It violates my constitutional rights. And there's kind of two levels of analysis here. First of all, does it violate the federal constitution? And secondly, what about the state constitution? Okay, with respect to the federal federal constitution, easy answer. For almost 200 years, the United States Supreme Court has held that these sorts of laws, quarantine laws, health laws, are constitutional. Our greatest early justice of the Supreme Court, Justice John Marshall, a man who gave us a fair amount of jurisprudence that exists to this day, once observed in a 1824 decision, Gibbons versus Ogden, if you're counting. We'll put it on our website. It's fun to go back and read an 1824 Supreme Court opinion. He observed that these sorts of laws, state quarantine and health laws, quote, are considered as flowing from the acknowledged power of a state to provide for the health of its citizens. Well, it's not just 1824. It goes on and on throughout the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court. I think maybe most notoriously, in 1905, in a decision called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, and we'll put this on our website as well, the Supreme Court upheld, get ready, mandatory vaccination for citizens. The author of the opinion in the Jacobson case, Justice John Marshall Harlan, noted that states had the authority, quote, to enact quarantine laws and health laws of every description. And he went on to say, and I'm quoting again, the liberty secured by the Constitution of the United States to every person within its jurisdiction does not import an absolute right in each person to be at all times and in all circumstances wholly freed from restraint. Now, I could go on here. I could cite you half a dozen more cases to the same effect, but let me just say, I don't see anything in the federal constitution that makes the lockdown orders unconstitutional at the federal level. And indeed, there is a constitutional provision that is broad enough to suggest to the contrary. And that's the 10th Amendment to the Constitution, which reserves to the states all powers not otherwise given to the federal government by the Constitution. And in fact, the Supreme Court and lower courts in deciding these quarantine and lockdown cases, they have cited the 10th Amendment as the support for their decisions. So what about at the state constitutional level? Well, I've got to give you one of those quibbling answers on that. It depends on how your Constitution is written. And that's pretty easy to discern. Just go look at your state's Constitution and see what authority is given to the state to act in the event of an emergency. Many state constitutions, every one I've read so far, gives the governor a tremendous amount of authority under these circumstances. But it does vary from state to state. So you've got to take a look at your own constitution. But don't, right? At least don't make that decision on your own as to whether or not a particular lockdown order is constitutional. Leave it to the courts for that. And there's enough in the way of litigation going on over these orders that you'll get your results pretty soon, whatever state you're in. I have one more small COVID-19 related issue that I want to talk about. It comes to us courtesy of Prince George's County in Maryland. That's a suburban county to Washington, D.C. And it concerns an issue that we've seen litigated a fair amount over the years. Can a public safety agency have a no beards policy? And the answer to the question has been, generally speaking, yes. There are no constitutional restrictions, the courts have said, on a grooming code, and that would include a no beards policy. However, and let's put two howevers on this. First of all, a grooming code is a mandatory subject to bargaining, so the employer would have to negotiate over changes in the grooming code. And secondly, the one that concerns us for purposes of this story is grooming codes implicate the Americans with Disabilities Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. In particular, no beards policies do. Why do they? They do because a requirement that all employees be clean shaven adversely impacts those employees who suffer from a condition known as pseudofolliculitis barbae. And that is a condition in which hair follicles become infected. It's quite painful, and it is exacerbated by shaving. PFB disproportionately affects African-American males. So you have Title VII, equal protection ramifications to a no-beards policy. And if it, of course, is a disability, it is a health condition that is covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act. That doesn't mean that an employer can't have a no-beards policy under either Title VII or the ADA. It just means it has to show a business necessity for the policy. And increasingly, courts are looking skeptically at the justification for a business necessity, with the exception of employees who have to wear face masks. You know where this is going, right? The story out of Prince George's County involves 25 officers in Maryland who were faced with an order from the county's health officer who issued a decree saying that beards were not compatible with protective face masks. The doctor said that CDC guidelines were clear on the issue, and therefore those officers with beards could not wear the N95 masks that every officer in the department had been issued. Initially, the police department announced that it was going to put the officers on unpaid leave. The union got involved. There was a big debate. The result, 25 officers, all of whom have PFB, are going to be placed on paid leave for the rest of the pandemic. Interesting result there. Let's go up the East Coast now for a fascinating case out of Somerville, Massachusetts. And it concerns a question we see argued about a lot, and you don't see it litigated much. Can you have different standards for older and younger employees? So this case involves Carlos Mello. He's been a police officer in Somerville, Massachusetts for 19 years. In 2002, he suffered an injury that resulted in the loss of almost all vision in his left eye. Nonetheless, he was cleared to return to work. He spent 5 years as a patrol officer and since 2007 has been in the position of a station officer, essentially a desk officer, where he's done everything that was asked of him by the city. In 2015, one of Mello's supervisors thinks he smells marijuana on Mello when Mello comes to work. Mello tells his captain, yeah, I smoke marijuana from time to time to relieve the migraines that resulted from my 2002 injury. The city then requires him to go through all sorts of ophthalmological examinations, and they concluded that Mello essentially had vision in only one eye, monocular vision. The city then placed Mello on unpaid suspension, revoked his firearms license, sent him a notice of potential termination, and initiated involuntary retirement proceedings with the local retirement board. I mean, like, wow, right? Can you imagine what that letter looked like? We're suspending you without pay. We're revoking your ability to carry a gun. We are going to terminate you, and we are also going to try to involuntarily retire you. Well, the system there in Somerville calls for three doctors to examine somebody who's being involuntarily retired. Two of the doctors said, can't work as a police officer if you have monocular vision, so he's not fit for duty. The third directly contradicted those conclusions and said that individuals with monocular vision frequently learn to compensate for their injuries, and in fact, Mello had learned to compensate for his injuries. So the board voted 2-1 to involuntarily retire Mello. And Mello sues, and he contends that his requirement violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. The case was thrown out at the trial court, and it went to the Federal First Circuit Court of Appeals, where the court was trying to decide whether or not Mello's complaint, that's the formal document that starts a civil lawsuit, whether Mello's complaint had alleged sufficient facts to potentially send to a jury, whether he could perform the essential functions of the job. And the court, in taking a look at that question, noted that the city was relying on a manual that was maintained by the Massachusetts Division of Human Resources. And this is the manual that is used for hiring standards. In fact, its title is Initial Hire Medical Standards. And that manual clearly identifies an inability to see 20/200 or better in either eye as a medical condition that is disqualifying. And the court ends up telling the city, your reliance on that manual may be illegal. It does not necessarily foreclose Mello's lawsuit. Why not? Here's the court's words. The manual only claims to set forth medical standards for initial hires. And while Massachusetts law also calls for medical standards for retaining current officers, the city does not point to any such standards or even claim that they exist. This next part of the court opinion I really like, and it's because the court is really saying, and the way that courts tend to say this stuff because they can't say it right out, we all know what happens when people get older, okay? Here's what the court's words were. There's good reason, too, to doubt that medical standards for new hires must be applied to remove experienced officers from service. After all, why would the Massachusetts legislature have called for the creation of two sets of standards if it expected all officers at all times to satisfy a single set? Officers foreseeably age, losing some physical prowess, but acquiring valuable experience and knowledge. And while a police department might prefer and expect new hires to be capable of assuming all entry positions, experienced officers are much more likely to acquire specific jobs, such as that of a station officer. And the court's bottom line is, Mello's failure to meet the initial hire standards is not enough to disqualify him on a per se basis from continued employment. It's going to come down to what the court refers to as, and I'm quoting again, the proof of the pudding. And here the court says, quote, this possibility, the possibility that someone with monocular vision could do the job, this possibility finds proof of the pudding in the eating. In 19 years, there has apparently never been an instance in which Mello's vision prevented him from successfully performing his job, nor does the city test the vision of its incumbent officers. In short, there's some evidence in the record to allow a reasonable jury to find that seeing at least 2100 in each eye is not a requirement for the job. Interesting case, and I think actually a very well-reasoned case. What's odd to me about it is it's really the first case of its kind that I've seen that takes into account, as the court puts it, the inevitability of aging. The last case I want to talk about is a really significant fitness for duty case. It comes out of Massachusetts as well, and this one is out of the City of Boston Police Department. And the police department in Boston has a policy that requires officers who return from extended leave without regard to the nature of the leave, why they went on leave, officers who are returning from extended leave have to undergo medical and psychological examinations before returning to work. And this policy was applied to two officers. Let me tell you about them. The first is an officer named James LaCroix. He's an officer who injured his back and hip while on duty, and he ended up on medical leave for those purposes. And when he was ready to come back to work, the department insisted that he undergo physical and psychological fitness for duty evaluations as a precondition to returning to work. Our second officer is Renee Payne Callender. She broke her foot while she was working. She too was placed on injury leave. When her doctor cleared her for light duty work, the department ordered her to a psychological fitness for duty evaluation. Payne Callender questioned whether anyone at the department had raised concerns regarding her mental health, and the doctor, when she got a chance to talk to him, said no, they had not. Those two officers sued, and they sued saying, you're violating the privacy provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Those privacy provisions say that an employer is not allowed to inquire about an employee's medical condition unless it has reasons to do so that are both job-related and consistent with business necessity. And as you know, if you're a listener to these podcasts for some time, courts are really strict about that. They require an employer to point to certain behavior, certain conduct on the part of the employee saying, look, this conduct gives a reasonable employer pause to wonder whether that employee can do the essential functions of the job, being a firefighter or police officer or whatever. So the lawsuit is filed. The city files what's known as a motion to dismiss the lawsuit, saying there is no basis for a claim here, and the court rejects the city's motion. What was the city arguing? The city was arguing, first of all, these officers weren't injured. All we did was to require an examination, and they both could eventually pass the examination. They weren't injured. Court says, yes, they were. They lost earning potential as they were required to wait to return to work after being medically cleared so that they could undergo their psychological examinations. And they could be subject to examinations in the future. So these injuries are sufficient to upon which to base a lawsuit. Secondly, the department says these officers have not established that they have disabilities. In fact, they're healed. And only people who have disabilities can bring lawsuits under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And this is where the court's opinion, I think, is so significant. The court says that's generally true. It is generally true that an employee has to prove that they are, in the parlance of the ADA, a qualified individual with a disability in order to bring an ADA lawsuit. But there's an exception, and the exception concerns the privacy provisions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. The court says it would be inconsistent with the purpose of the medical examination and inquiry prohibitions to require that an employee demonstrate that he or she has a disability before challenging an employer's inquiry. The third thing that the department argued was that the officers, in their complaint that they filed, failed to adequately allege that the medical and psychological examinations weren't job-related and consistent with business necessity. And the court says, you got that part wrong. It's not the officers who have to prove that the tests, the examinations, aren't job-related and consistent with business necessity. City, you've got to prove that they are. That is your burden of proof. And you know what? It is a high burden of proof. I'm going to read you two sentences out of the court's opinion. The Boston Police Department bears the burden of proving that the challenged examinations do not violate the ADA because they are sufficiently job-related and consistent with business necessity. Employers bear the quite high burden of establishing that compelled medical examinations are consistent with business necessity. The last thing I want to talk about this month is actually quite personal. It's prompted by emails that we've received from you. Those emails ask, how are you doing at LRIS? How are you holding up under the conditions of the pandemic? And I really thank you so much for getting in touch with us. And also, for many of you have written in kind words about the services that we provide. And I wish I could give you a rosy, optimistic answer to that question, but it's really difficult to do so. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about LRIS now, maybe a little bit more than you want to know, but I'll tell you about it anyway. LRIS has been in business now for more than 35 years. I started it a long time ago out of the notion that public safety employees just simply didn't have adequate information, and employers, adequate information about employee rights in the workplace. And it was totally a lark. We held our first seminar, I think, in about 1983 or 84, somewhere in there, and did it just on a wing and a prayer. And over the years, we built this business of publishing books and the newsletter, and we have now the app that we issue, that we monitor. We've got the podcasts, and of course, we have the seminars. What has been challenging for us right now is that most of the income from LRIS comes from our seminars. It's over 90%. I'll be upfront with you about that. And we're not able to put on seminars right now. There's just no way it would be the responsible thing to do. Even if we could do it, it would just not be the responsible thing to do. We had to postpone our first ever wellness and fitness seminar. I was really excited about having that. Had to postpone it. It was scheduled for April in Nashville. We postponed it to July. We just now had to postpone it again until October. We had to cancel our Rights of Police seminar in June. That's a seminar we've held every year since there was an LRIS. And now we have three seminars left for the rest of the year. We've got grievances and arbitration in September, the wellness and fitness seminar in October, and then advanced police discipline, which we're going to have in Las Vegas in November. Will those seminars happen? I hope so. If they do happen, we are going to insist on the tightest protocols that we can possibly insist upon with these hotels. It'll probably mean capping attendance at relatively low levels so we can have appropriate social distancing in terms of seating in the seminar rooms. We're going to have to have fewer people, clearly, in a seminar room. It may mean a change in our lunches. We've had some buffet lunches. I can't imagine going to a buffet lunch in the future. It'll mean insisting that the hotels sanitize everything and then re-sanitize everything and then re-sanitize everything again. There's lots of changes where, you know, that we would be insisting upon. We might even change our own registration policy as to how people show up and get registered for the seminars. We're going to try to hold those seminars if at all possible. People are asking us to. I think it would be really important and valuable if we could hold those seminars. But we're not going to do it if it's not safe for people to come to the seminars. And so we're in the same place all of you are right now, which is with uncertainty as to what the future is going to bring with respect to your work lives. I've had to make the very, very difficult decision to lay off two of our staffers at LRIS, Claire and Victoria. Claire is the person who runs all of our seminars. Victoria has taken on a very valuable role for us in helping people with the union app that we have, and just generally does a wide variety of jobs around LRIS. LRIS is now Mark Fuller and me. We're kind of holding in. We dearly miss Claire and Victoria, who in addition to being wonderful employees, are just nice people. And it's just a terrible situation that we're in. But you can't run a business without income. And that's where we find ourselves. I'll make this commitment to you. We're going to keep plugging. And we're going to keep plugging as long as we possibly can, as long as there's even a glimmer that we're able to run this business on, not even a break-even basis, right? But approaching a break-even basis. We're going to try to do that. We're looking at all sorts of ideas about how we could restructure the seminars to be online seminars. We don't have great ideas in that department yet because our seminars, 2.5 days, people can't sit still for an online course that is 2.5 hours, much less 2.5 days. Might be able to break it into pieces, I don't know. But we'll see. We're just going to do everything that we possibly can. So thanks to all of you who have sent in your expressions of concern. It really means a lot to us. And the praise that you've given us over the last few weeks about the services that we provide, that we have provided, it's really heartwarming. And thanks a lot. This is Will Aitchison signing off.